Thanks, Tim, for the very kind introduction. And I'm Adrian Poe, and today I'll be talking about what we call lattice homotopy. And it's kind of defined loosely by saying that we try to move things around and call them the same. So I want to begin by apologizing for the somewhat goofy title. It's just like documenting my failure to give a good colloquium style talk, maybe. But given the goofiness of a title anyway, let me just go ahead with that and start with this slide. So I should also confess that I took this slide, the inspiration of this slide is from the talk by Nugent's last week, exactly like 1 week ago, maybe in the same room even. So maybe we can make it a tradition that all the condensed talk at PI has to begin with this slide. So, but whoever that wrote this, he or she actually understands condensed matter physics really, really well. It kind of resonates with every single line that's written there. But in particular, let me highlight this line about the hobby, which is to say that we kind of pack things in teeny, tiny spaces and just to see what happens. And let me just give you a visual idea of what that means. So imagine these are like atoms arranged in a crystal, and the typical length scale for this size is maybe 20 nanometer. And you can just contrast that with a strand of human hair, and on the very thin side of things is like 20 microns, so the range is like 70 micron to 200 micron maybe. So this is obviously not drawn to scale, and if I would draw this to scale, it's like that. So if I shrink that crystal to 1 pixel, then this is the size of human hair. So that's really what we meant by packing a lot of stuff into teeny tiny spaces. And that is really about something of the microscopic problem. And when we ask the question of what happens, it's really about the macroscopic. And that's really defining the condensed matter physics problem. So to illustrate why this is non-trivial, let me show this example of what I would call the problem of quantum many-body problems. So imagine you're in some exam, and it's a terrible exam. They ask you that you have some spin half systems. It's arranged in this called hyperkagami lattice. And for each spin, you have some coupling. Maybe only nearest neighbor is antiferromagnetic. And you're asked to find this ground state. So the punchline is that it's basically impossible to do it. At least it's a very long trivial question, and I don't think we know the answer for this particular problem. So it's a very simple problem to state, but it's almost impossible to answer them. And let me just elaborate on that point. It's a simple problem to state because we essentially have only an order one number of parameters. Maybe we need to specify what are the degrees of freedom. So these are, say, spin half. We need to specify how they're arranged in space, like in these teeny tiny spaces. And then we also need to specify how they are coupled. So at the end of the day, it's like not many parameters. But it's also impossible to really just like write down the answer. And the reason is what you all know. So if I give you, say, V spin half, then the dimension of a Hilbert space is 2 to V. So just put in numbers, if I give you a 1 micron sample, and remember the packing distance is like 1 nanometer or something, so you easily have the Hilbert space dimension being 2 to the power 10 to 8, and which is essentially 2 to the power 10 to 8 gigabytes. And last time I looked up, the total data stored in our world is only 2 to 40. So this is essentially like order one compared to that. So we just have no way to solve this problem exactly. And that's the problem of condensed matter physics, or most of many of the quantum many-body physics, which is that although when we think about it as in packing in teeny tiny spaces, there are not many parameters. And when you try to measure things in a lab, which is at the microscopic scale, again, there are not many parameters. But these two ends are really separated by the size of the Hilbert space, which is really crazily big. And the grand problem is to ask how we can go from the microscopic to the macroscopic. And we really want to ask what information here is relevant if we want to extract useful information on the macroscopic scale. So we just stare at these kind of pictures, and then we ask what information is really important when I draw such a lattice. And that will bring me again back to this slide. So as a warning, I'll show this repeatedly. So this is supposed to be a dating profile, and then apparently condensed matter is trying to look for someone who can help harness my untapped potential. And let me make a suggestion here today that maybe psychology is the right match. So I speak of it with a clear personal bias because my fiance is a psychologist. But then she does randomly tell me things about like children, like cognitive development and whatnot. Think about a 10-year plan for like prep class for fatherhood. So there's this psychologist called Jean Piaget. He's like a 20th century psychologist, and he's interested in epistemology. So basically, he wanted to understand how people learn any things. And according to his theory, the first stage for kids from 0 to 2 years old is called sensory motor play. So there's a lot of academic terms but it's as simple as the following. If I have a baby and I give my baby two toy cars, so what would he or she do to toy cars? So they will most likely like take them, grab them, move them, and then collide them. So that's usually how babies try to explore the world. They move things around and then they try to see what will happen. And this really what happens, except that this is a pretty special baby because he or she can move things without ever touching them, and that's like psychokinetic power, which happens to be useful if we go to condensed matter physics, because we don't have only two toy cars, we have the periodic array of them. And when you have psychokinetic babies, then they can just move them coherently and collide and see what happens. Now that we assume he or she can have psychokinetic power, it's not such a bad assumption to even assert that they think in some topological manner. So really, the punchline today is to ask this question. If we think about these periodic arrangements of degrees of freedom, maybe atoms, maybe cars, and we try to move them around in some symmetric manner, and then we want to extract what are the actual invariants in the system. And that's the overarching theme. So let me just repeat that in a slightly more precise manner. So we want to answer how does the conventional notion of topology interact with our understanding on quantum ground states. So usually when I introduce topology, I always say, oh, you think about oranges being distinct from a bagel, but bagel being similar to coffee mugs. It's really this kind of visualization of how you can deform your surfaces in a smooth manner and see what is conserved or what is not changing. And this is what I meant by conventional notion of topology. And today we want to study that and then ask how they can interact with our understanding of quantum many-body problems. And more precisely, let me define or give a definition of what I mean by lattice homotopy. It's basically putting that idea into work. So we will ask the following question: what are the robust topological data in a lattice under smooth symmetric deformation? So I'll be a bit more specific later. And after asking that question, we have some topological invariants, and then we'll ask how they affect the quantum phases of matter that we get, or how to constrain it. So that may conclude the goofiness of my goofy part of my talk, and the rest may be slightly more serious. So this is the outline of the talk, and together with actually the take-homes. So I'll first introduce this idea of what we call Lipschitz matter theorem, and that essentially a sort of no-go for what I would put in quote here, like boring phases, and I will be more specific later. And this turns out to be a motivated example of this idea of lattice constraints or moving lattice sites around and seeing what are the invariants. And then I'll introduce more properly the idea of lattice homotopy, discuss a general framework within the context of quantum magnets. And then I will show how this can be used to generalize the Lipschitz matter theorem to essentially all space groups. And then lastly, I will cover how these ideas can be applied to the study of atomic insulators and how that can now be enable us to actually go look for possible quantum materials in the real world. So let me begin by introducing this theorem by Lipschitz and Mattis. So the setup is the following. We think about a one-dimensional spin chain, and we assume that we have translation invariant, like a discrete lattice translation, and also spin rotation symmetry. So in particular, what I've shown here is that this is one lattice constant. So this is like one unit cell. And I start with having exactly one spin half per unit cell. So that's the setup. And then you can write down some Hamiltonian, which is local in space, and then respect the spin rotation symmetries and the lattice translation symmetry. So you write down some local Hamiltonian. So that's the microscopic data. It's just basically drawn here. And then the theorem would tell you that if you start with this microscopic data, at the macroscopic level, the ground state must either break symmetry or be gapless. So maybe it's clearer if I tell you what is disallowed. So what is really disallowed is the option of having some unique ground state which is symmetric and gapped. So the theorem here is telling you that when you have such a setup with one spin half per unit cell and these symmetries, this is never an option. So this is a non-trivial example of how you can relate some simple sounding microscopic data directly to the behavior of your quantum many-body system at the macroscopic level, because the presence of symmetry breaking or gapless excitation is something you can measure in a lab. And to contrast or to give you a better insight on what is the content of this theorem, let me give you the long examples. So this is maybe one of the most famous non-Lipschitz matters kind of setup. Again, you think about one-dimensional spin chain, again, transition, like discrete transition symmetry and spin rotation symmetry. I've highlighted for you what a different in this slide compared to the previous one. What is different now is that at the microscopic level, for every unit cell, I put a spin one instead of a spin half. And at the macroscopic level, now you realize that the ground state can be just gapped and fully symmetric and have a unique ground state. In fact, it has a famous, it's a famous state that is called either the Hodding phase or the AKLT phase. And it's a very early example of what is now known as symmetry protected topological order. So let me just reiterate that what you're changing is only one small bit of the microscopic data. You change a spin half per unit cell into a spin one per unit cell, but then you have completely different behavior for the ground state at the microscopic level. And this may look a little bit mysterious, but there's a more clear example of some Lorentz matter setup, which is kind of similar, but more explicit. Again, we think about one-dimensional spin chain, again, transition symmetry, spin rotation symmetry. What is now different is that for every unit cell, I put in two spin halves. So when you have two spin halves per unit cell, I can easily arrange for a singlet state. So I just pair the two spins in this unit cell into a singlet. And this respects the transition symmetry, this respects the spin rotation symmetry. And I clearly just have a unique ground state, just a collection of spin singlet. So that would give you an explicit visualization that when you have this kind of data, two spin halves per unit cell at the microscopic level, then the macroscopic ground state can be gapped and symmetric. And we see that it's really distinct from the original Lipschitz matter setup for which this is allowed. So we should now give a somewhat heuristic explanation on why the microscopic data can so drastically constrain the macroscopic physics you see.
Sorry.
Yes.
In the example of by translation invariance, you mean translation by two sides, right?
That's right. So I mean translation by a lattice constant.
Oh, okay.
So here I color these to say maybe these are different atoms, for instance. So this is related to that inner transition. This is related to that inner transition. So really the transition is to take this pair to that pair. So let me give you a heuristic explanation on why you expect that to be the case. And we will start by considering a single unit cell. So on the left-hand side is the contest for the original Lipschitz matter spherium. We have a single unit cell, we have a single spin half in the unit cell. And we have spin rotation symmetry. So the two states of my spin half are actually degenerate. But if I compare it with the right-hand side, so I start in the beginning with two spin halves in the unit cell, then I can arrange for the singlet already. So the single unit cell level is already non-degenerate. And now we just have to take this unit cell data and propagate it to the macroscopic scale using the transition symmetry. Because if I take a single unit cell, I demand transition symmetry that will give me a macroscopic sample already. So on the left-hand side, in every unit cell of a single spin half, and now I try to get a macroscopically back system by applying transition symmetry. In particular, let me use a periodic boundary condition and suppose my ring has size L and L is an odd number, so it's my choice. So when I combine an odd number of spin halves, then when you fuse the spins all together, at the end of the day, you get some channels, but then they're always half integer spins that you get. What that means is that all the states in the Hilbert space here would be degenerate under the spin rotation symmetry. In particular, the ground state is no exception, so the ground state cannot be unique and symmetric. So that's really like a heuristic explanation on why in this setup you have this constraint on the ground state. And on the right-hand side, so you again do the same exercise and then you put this, repeat it an odd number of times, but then you just combine a collection of singlet, so the ground state can be just non-degenerate. So this is really the difference between the two setups, and this explains why you can expect to have Lipschitz matter spherium, which relates the microscopic data to the macroscopic behavior. And that was a pretty old theorem, maybe a few decades, like 5 decades or so. But then the recent revisit of these problems tells us that there's actually an alternative point of view, which is coming from this heuristic explanation I gave you already. So we specify the microscopic data, say we have lattice translations and spin rotation symmetries, and I tell you whether in each unit cell I have half integer spins or integer spins. And let me give you this slightly more complicated example in which I arrange for three spin halves in a unit cell. But now we are going to start deforming my lattice in a way that respects all the symmetries. In particular, I focus only on lattice translation. So I can try to move maybe these spins forward and backward, but in a way that respects the transition symmetry. And if you just pay close attention to the content of this unit cell during this movie, so I can just do this again, you'll always have exactly three spin halves in any instance of time. So no matter how you deform your lattice, there's a sense in which there's a topological invariant in terms of the content in the unit cell. And for that demonstration, we are saying that there's always three spin halves in a unit cell. But that may not be really the invariant, because I could have also just say that maybe I pair these two into a spin singlet, which is a spin zero state, and I kind of forget it in my Hilbert space. So I can just get rid of that. So having three spin half per unit cell is not so different from having a single spin half or five spin half or so on and so forth. What is important is that we have a half integer spin per unit cell. And this is the invariant that cannot change under these kind of smooth symmetric deformation of my spin lattice. So this is what I would call lattice homotopy. We try to deform the lattice in a way that comply with the rules, which are symmetries and smooth deformation. And we try to extract the piece of data of the lattice that is actually invariant. So as in many of the topological questions, you want to ask if that's the only invariant or not. So of course, that has some intellectual appeal to this question by itself. But let me also argue that this question is of relevance to actually materials research, or trying to ask how these ideas can be applicable to the real world. And again, apologies for showing this again and again, but then let me just emphasize that the real world is kind of complex, and I think this is the last time I show this, at least for this talk. So how complicated can that be? So shown here is the crystal structure for ytterbium 2, titanium 2, titanium oxide. It's actually relatively simple by the scale of things. It just looks like a mass of three types of atoms, and it's called pyrochore lattice. And it turns out it's what is known to be something like a spin liquid candidate. So that can be having a very interesting quantum mechanical ground state. And this is showing you something like a conventional unit cell, and you can go to what is called primitive unit cell, is slightly cleaner. But the important thing is that you actually have four ytterbium atoms in this primitive unit cell. So what is important here is that these basically give you one Kramer's doublet per atom. So you have four Kramer's doublet per unit cell. So remember the content of Lipschitz metaspherium was that if you have an half integer spin per unit cell, then you can have some constraint on a possible quantum many-body ground state. But for a reasonably looking real-world material, you have four of them, so you should ask if the Lipschitz metaspherium theorem is applicable or not, or whether we can actually generalize Lipschitz metaspherium theorem to even take into account these kind of more complicated real-world example. So the philosophy is that these examples are complex, but they're actually quite orderly. It doesn't look like a huge mess, at least when I show a single primitive unit cell. So to tackle these kind of systems, we should really make better use of the spatial symmetries. So let me now go beyond just the translation symmetry and talk about what are the other possible crystal symmetries that are important for us. And the first generalization we're going to do will be to cover what we call non-symorphic symmetries. And again, I'll illustrate it using like periodic toy cars. So this is something like a crystal, if you like. And these are the more regular kind of translation symmetries. You see that the pattern is invariant under this translation, as well as under that translation. But what is important for my purpose here is to note that you actually have something which is like a mirror plane. It's this one. So if I really apply a mirror of my structure along this line, this car is going to be mapped to that one. So that's not quite a symmetry because there was nothing there. But now you can move this forward by half a unit cell and it becomes a symmetry. So this is what we would call a glide mirror, or just a glide operation. And it's combining a reflection with a half lattice translation. So the technical term for these kind of operations, they're called non-symorphic symmetries. And actually, that has some interesting interplay with topology already. So let me just do it schematically. So if I give you like a square or a rectangle, and I try to identify these two sides with a regular translation, then this is periodic boundary condition on this side. But let me now identify this side and that side by a glide reflection. So I will first take this line, reflect orientation, and then identify the two edges. So this, as you know, is giving you the Klein bottle. And let me just put in my periodic toy cars onto this. And you really think about it as having you have some crystal or some lattices of these degrees of freedom. And you can actually use the glide symmetry in your system to consistently define it on a Klein bottle. But this has an interesting consequence, which is the following. Let me first emphasize this point. So if you think about doing this kind of lattice homotopy procedure, so I want to move my degrees of freedom around while resetting all the symmetries. In particular, if I try to drag this row of car forward, then it actually flips and go into this other row. So that's really the homotopy kind of procedures you can do in this setup. And that is to show you that this putting this lattice on the Klein bottle is actually respecting all the spatial symmetries in the system. But there's another more important point, which is that I've consistently put my system on the Klein bottle, but I have only 5 cars on this space. So if you do the unit cell count, so when you look at the original problem, in every unit cell, you actually have 2 cars, because these are related by translation, and then this end, maybe that is related by translation. So in every unit cell, you have 2 cars. But when I try to put my system on the Klein bottle using the glide symmetry, I successfully put it in a symmetric manner with only 5 cars, or for that matter, an odd number of cars. So that would mean that I've actually used only 2.5 of unit cells. So more generally, I can actually expose fractions of the unit cell by defining my system on some not topologically non-trivial manifold. And when you expose something like a fraction of the unit cell, you can now detect a stronger version of the Lipschitz Mattis theorem. So in particular, you can now prove that if these cars are actually spin half, then you can generalize the original Lipschitz Mattis theorem to state that for such a system with glide refraction symmetry, there's also a no-go for having a gap unique ground state. And that was an illustration for the two-dimensional Klein bottle. And you can ask, how do you do it more systematically? And turns out in 3 dimensions, it has been classified that there are exactly 10 flat manifolds that we are calling them Bieber-Bach manifolds. And they are really like the generalization of Klein bottles into 3 dimensions. And the names, they have interesting names that are shown here. And shown on your left is what is called the didychism or didychism. I don't know how you should say it. But then it looks a bit complicated. It's like you identify this phase with that phase of a rotation, and then you identify this Q phase, or maybe shown here is identifying the R phase with a rotation and then identify this edge. So it may be complicated to construct it, but then these are all classified. And turns out for any possible 3-dimensional crystal, you can consistently put it on one of these 10 Bieber-Bach manifolds. And when you put it on the right one, you can expose the strongest Lipschitz-Mattis constraint you can get using these kind of arguments. So maybe I should pause a little bit to see if there's any questions or anything is unclear. Okay, so let me just give you a summary on this very first part. So to reiterate, the idea of Lipschitz-Mattis theorem is the following. We want to study the microscopic data, and we ask which part of that is topological. In particular, the data that's important for us is that in each fundamental domain, so for instance, if it's just translation symmetry, the fundamental domain will be the unit cell. But if you have something like a glide reflection symmetry, then the fundamental domain can be half of the unit cell. So if you have a half integer spin per fundamental domain, then you can apply the arguments and show that the quantum ground state has to be interesting. It's either symmetry breaking, or maybe gapless, or even topologically ordered. So in particular, you rule out the possibilities of having something like a decoupled spin singlet ground state. Yes.
Is it possible to have a 1/3 of 4
unit cells? Yes. So that would be, let me make sure that is right. Yeah, I think you have 3 1 screws, so that's possible. So 1/3 meaning here. So these are called trichism, but that's like you rotate by 120 degrees, and then you translate by 1/3 of the unit cell.
Number.
You cannot, because of these crystallographic selection, whatever. So the rotations can only be 2, 3, 4, or 6. Yeah. So all the possible fractions of the unit cells that you can expose are basically listed here. Right. So that's one generalization of the Lipschitz-Mattis theorem. We've tried to expand its power from talking about only this half integer spin per unit cell into these more complicated versions for which a fundamental domain can be fractions of the unit cell. But there's a downside to that argument, which is again coming back to this ytterbium titanate. And it's not covered by this generalization, as it turns out. So if you try to apply these Bieber-Bach argument on this and whatnot, you still cannot make any definite claim. So it looks like this may be compatible with a trivial ground state. So that pushes us to even try harder. And that would take us to the next point. So I've given you a flavor of these ideas about how to move things around and see what is the invariant. But then next, we want to develop a more general framework that will cover basically all the possible spatial symmetries. And that is really the general framework for what we call lattice homotopy, and I will illustrate it concretely using quantum magnets. So along that line, we'll again discuss some more crystal symmetries. So actually, these are the more conventional ones. So the Lanczymorphic one is not the usual one you first learn about. But turns out that is Now, these more conventional ones are somewhat harder. So for instance, consider a regular mirror symmetry. So if this is a mirror plane, and you have a lattice site on the right-hand side, then you apply the mirror, and that will tell you that there should be another site on the other side. That's just saying there's a mirror symmetry. And you also have rotation symmetries, which means that if this system is symmetric about this point, and let's say it's a six-fold rotation, then you demand that there are also sites along all these, or at all these rotation-related points. So what is important for us here is to notice that for both the mirror as well as the rotation, there are actually fixed points in space. And that is really different from translation or what I call Lonsdale-Morphic symmetry. So in the earlier example, any operations will move every point in space. But for mirrors and rotations, that's not true. And the fixed points are actually special. So they're special for the following reason. If I think about the same set of symmetries, let's say more concretely, I have six-fold rotation, I have mirror symmetry, and some lattice translations. And you have distinct types of fixed points in space. And turns out all these three classes of lattices, which are somewhat famous, are all having the same set of symmetries, except that the fixed points are different. So for the triangular lattice, this point is just symmetric under the entire point group. So it's symmetric under this mirror and also that rotation. But for the honeycomb lattice, if you look at the origin, there's actually no site there, and the sites are arranged at the vertices of these hexagons. So you'll see that the vertices by themselves, or maybe this is a site, it actually doesn't have six-fold rotation symmetry. In the six-fold rotation, it goes to some other site. But it has some three-fold rotation symmetry locally, or if you like, it's symmetric under this three-fold rotation combined with a translation back. So this point is also having some point group symmetry that is leaving that point invariant, but it's different from the triangular lattice. And you can try to play the same game for what is called a Kagame lattice. And turns out these points, they only have a two-fold rotation symmetry and also a mirror symmetry. And let me just clarify one point, which is here I'm going to use the word lattice in the more condensed matter kind of way. But for those of you with a more mathematical background, you think about lattice as a different kind of definition. So in particular, these don't really form a group. That's the main distinction. So I mean lattice as in that these are honeycomb lattices. These are some periodic orderly arrangement of points in space. So that's the starting point. We specify our symmetries, and then we see that there could be distinct type of lattices. And now we have to, well, we want to apply this idea that I call lattice homotopy. We want to try to see how we can maybe move things around in some symmetric manner and see to how we can extract the topological invariant of that. So to do that explicitly, so this is the kind of decorated version of what I just showed you, but then it has the same set of symmetries. Again, a mirror symmetry about this plane, and also six-fold rotation symmetry about this point, and then also lattice translation here and there. So this is my starting point. I have some decorated, complicated-looking lattice, but now I can perform operations by just moving the sites around in a symmetric manner, and in particular, I can collapse these three points into a single point, and you will see that this becomes the honeycomb lattice. So the conclusion of that movie is that if I start with this original version, and I can symmetrically deform it and collapse the sites onto points, then I can recover the honeycomb. But I can also do it the other way around. I can also start with the same initial decorated lattice, but now I move my sites in some other manner. I will actually drag these two together and combine them. And that will give me the Kagame. So this is a way in which we basically achieve this lattice homotopy move. We start with the degrees of freedom in space, move them symmetrically around. And then we see that the same initial lattice can be deformed to both ends. And they're suggesting that, in fact, up to the rules I've specified, I move them around and there may be some kind of equivalence relations, then the honeycomb is really equivalent to the Kagame, or maybe not. So we should be a bit more careful. Because here I'm only showing you the lattice points, and I haven't been too careful when I mentioned how we collapse the sites into the new degrees of freedom, and we should put that back in. So this is really just questions about the lattice homotopy of lattice sites, but then we should ask about the homotopy of lattice of spins. So there are additional rules in how we combine spin degrees of freedom together. And in particular, let me denote a half integer spin by this filled circle. And an integer spin will be this empty circle. So the rule is just that when I fill an odd number of half integer spins, then I get a half integer spin at the end of the day. But if I fuse an even number of them, then I will get an integer spin. So this is just illustrating the relevant moves. And with that preparation, I can now play my movie again, but keeping track of this rule. So now, when I move the spins around and I try to collapse these three together, I follow this kind of fusion rule, and I will conclude that I get, at the end of the day, a honeycomb lattice of spin, half integer spins. But now if I play the second movie, for which we'll try to fuse the spins along this other line, when I move them and I fuse them, then the combining two half integer spins will give me an integer spin. So although we've seen that you can get both the honeycomb as well as the kagome, starting with the same initial lattice of spins, actually they are not the same kind of spins. So on the left-hand side, you have a honeycomb lattice of half integer spins. And on the right-hand side, you'll have a kagome lattice of integer spins. So without showing you this middle movie, that's actually a non-trivial statement that these two are somewhat related to each other, but it's actually right. So under these moves that we call lattice homotopy, a honeycomb lattice of half-integer spins are actually equivalent to an integer lattice of kagome spins. So now you can ask yourself this question. Do you expect a Lipschitz-Mattis theorem kind of constraint or no-go on this problem? So if I just focus on this particular problem, it looks like you have spin halves that are distributed in space, and it's actually very non-trivial to write down any symmetric gap Gram-Steer wave function for this particular problem. But now under this homotopy equivalence, we see that this is equivalent to some other lattices of kagome spins, but then these are only integer spins. So you can imagine that you probably can write down a symmetric gap Gram-Steer on this side. So by the equivalence of these two lattices, we realize that you can actually do the same on this. With some caveats, so something like maybe you need to supply additional trivial degrees of freedom and so on and so forth. But chances of there are numerical studies that suggest that you probably don't need to supply additional degrees of freedom, but it's very much tied to this interfacing kind of lattices that you can use to construct some tensor network wave functions. So to conclude this part, we have basically shown that these two are equivalent under lattice homotopy moves. And in particular, this is just some lattice of integer spins, and it's actually a trivial class. So the half integer spin honeycomb lattice is in fact trivial. But then you can do it more systematically with all the possible lattices with the same set of symmetries, and you'll discover that there are two non-trivial types. And basically they are just, they arise by arranging half integer spins into the honeycomb or into the triangular lattice. So for both of them, the total count of spins in each unit cell will be half integer. So you will say, oh, for both of them, you just have the regular Lipschitz lattice. But this is doing something more, because that will tell you that there are two distinct types of lattices. In fact, you could have superposed this with that, then you have some more complicated looking lattices in the same space group, but you now have four spin half per unit cell. And you can show that this is still non-trivial. And in fact, you expect an obstruction for getting a gap trivial Gram-Steer. So this is how we've gone beyond the original Lipschitz lattice kind of constraint and go beyond just the total count of unit cell or the fundamental domain. So for the next few minutes, let me spend some time on this slightly more technical slide, which is just to attempt to formalize all the pictures and movies I've shown already and give you a taste of the mathematical structure that is behind all these calculations. So really what we are saying is that you think about the lattice data. So this lambda here, it's basically a collection of points in space. And for each point in space, we attach some data, which is the representation. In particular, this omega x, x is the point in space, will be an element of z2. And this z2 is a classification of the projective representation of the spin rotation group, SO3. So really, it's just to say this z2 is 0 corresponding to integer spin and 1 corresponding to half integer spin. So that's the data. And starting with that data, we can imagine composing systems. So if I give you a system one, maybe lattice one, I can compose it with lattice two. So the lattice data, this points in space, you just take the union essentially. And then you also understand how basically you just inherit the original assignment of representation, the projective representations, the omega one and omega two. So you just add that. But because I can do this composition, you basically have like an abelian operation. And you may wonder if this is a group or whatnot, but then this is a group to start with, so you can easily make this an abelian group. So now this is an abelian group, and you can further argue that it's a finitely generated abelian group, just because you know what are the basic elements that will allow you to generate all the possible lattices and they are the special lattices of fixed points. So for this example, I've shown you already about the six-fold rotation and so forth. There are three generators. They are essentially the honeycomb, the triangular lattice, and the triangular lattice, and also the kagome. So you always have a finite set of generators. And for each of them, you can talk about whether for each of the sides you assign an integer or half integer representation. So you get naturally some finitely generated abelian groups. But then this is a redundant counting because maybe we have relations like the half integer honeycomb is equivalent to the integer kagome. So you need to also impose these equivalent relations. And once you take these equivalence relations into account, then you'll get what we call the lattice homotopy invariance. And that is really, you can think of it as a classification of the lattices of spins in terms of these projected representations. And turns out that's something that is relatively easy to compute. And this is the result we had for two dimensions, and there are only 17 wallpaper groups. And they all look simple-ish. It's basically some collections of C2s to different powers. And in particular, the example I gave is actually wallpaper group 17. So there are two generators, the half-integer spin triangular lattice or the half-integer spin kagome. And we show this table in this form just for simplicity. In fact, the calculation can be done systematically and automated. So you can also go to the three dimension and generalize slightly from just the two possible projective representations of SO3 to generally maybe some ZN classification of the projective representation. And you can just automate it and compute it. And the result is like that. And good, that ended. So that's really some calculation that you can quite easily automate. And that has been done, in fact, although we never quite published a three-dimensional table because we just want to illustrate the idea and show it explicitly for the two-dimensional case. So far, we've only been talking about the lattice degrees of freedom. But now let's connect back to the macroscopic physics. So we've basically focused only on the microscopic data, right? And we've tried to extract the piece of the microscopic data that is topologically meaningful. And we've concluded by saying that it's these kind of invariant groups. So now we've made a conjecture back then that basically any lattices of spins that are homotopy non-trivial in the way we described it would come with it some kind of constraint of the Lipschitz Mattis type, meaning you cannot get a symmetric gap unique ground state. So the statement is really written here. And while we've provided something like a physicist kind of proof for a restricted setting, more technically it's two-dimension, assuming the absence of spin-orbit coupling and maybe at least some subgroup of the spin rotation group. So let me just mention that it has actually been proven more generally for essentially all possible classes of quantum magnets that are of relevance to the real world. This direct proof is mostly in this paper by Elson and Frangen, but then it's really closely related to a very large body of work on the study of topological crystalline symmetry protected topological orders. This is a very long, exhaustive list of the people involved in this classification story. So that is how we applied this idea of lattice homotopy and tried to generalize this Lipschitz Mattis problem or idea, this paradigm, to a more complicated setup. And the upshot is that finally we can handle this beast, the Eutherium titanate. So it turns out this one is lattice homotopy non-trivial. And now you can really look at this material and claim that if it doesn't break a symmetry, if it's gapped, then it has to be a spinequid. So that would conclude the second part of my talk. So maybe I should pause a little bit to see if there are any questions. Okay, with that, then let me move on to the last part, which is how we can use this kind of lattice homotopies framework, which is quite general, in fact, although I've focused on spin like quantum magnet systems and focused on whether it's a projective representation or linear representations, spin half integer spins versus integer spins. But you can also play the same game with all kinds of things that you can do in real space. In particular, we can apply it to atomic insulators. So more specifically, we mean the following. So instead of thinking about spin degrees of freedom, namely whether it's half integer or integer spins, we just replace the real space degrees of freedom attached to the lattice sites. We replace them by electronic orbitals. So this is a picture, a very nice picture I took from Wikipedia on the hydrogen wave functions. Essentially, they're labeled by some quantum numbers. And the principal quantum numbers and different angular momentums and so on and so forth. And we are just replacing the data of spin being integer, half integer by these kind of possible orbitals. And in the crystal environment, you also notice that these may not be really distinct in the sense that you can mix them. because in a crystal you don't have full rotation symmetry, so maybe the angular momentum is only defined modulo n. So you put that into account, and they will give you the initial data. There will be a collection of sites, and on each site you put in some electronic orbitals. And we can try to construct an insulator by saying that all these orbitals are fully filled. So that's the setup, and then we can again try to do lattice homotopy. So we'll put these sites, have these sites around, and for each site we'll put in some electronic orbitals. But then the homotopy rules will be slightly different because we're no longer fusing spins themselves. What we're really talking about here is actually the representations of the point group. So for instance, imagine you have this point which has a three-fold rotation symmetry, so which is shown schematically here. And maybe in my original lattice, I have three sites. Each of them has maybe like an S orbital. So these are related by three-fold rotation. And you can write down the representation matrix of this three-fold rotation, and it will be written this way. So you transform the first site to the second site and so on and so forth. But you can just diagonize it, which is like a basis rotation, right? So you'll see that when you diagonize it, it just has three diagonal eigenvalues. So one omega, omega squared. Omega is the third root of unity. So if I rewrite this, or if I picture this matrix, what that means is that this collection of three S orbitals is actually equivalent to saying you have one S-like orbital and then some superpositions of Px and Py in that language. But if you don't like the more chemistry kind of language, what is important is just that you can have different types of representations of the site symmetry. So this three sites off the symmetry point would be equivalent for to the sum of these three distinct orbitals with different characters and the transformations. So that is the thing we need to change. We play the same lattice homotopy game. We attach the orbitals to the sites in space. We move the sites around in some symmetric manner. And whenever the sites collide, we try to fill them using these kind of rules that you can derive. And then we'll be able to compute essentially what are the topological invariance of these kind of lattices of maybe atomic insulators. So we again can build the macroscopic data starting from the microscopic one. And the output will again be some finitely generated abelian group. This is some distinction here that we're now starting to see C to D, so it's no longer like a finite group. Just because of the representation theory, so you can actually have some free factors. And then you can have more complicated versions of the torsions. But then it's kind of the same EC-ish calculation, again, with many pages. I've shown you only a small subset of those. So I think my PDF file had 20 pages, and I've shown you like four of them only. But you get the idea. So you can compute these relatively easily for maybe all possible settings that you can find in the world. Like in three dimensions, there are only 1,651 magnetic space groups, but it's a finite number, and these are computationally easy, so you can just do all those, and you get these 20 pages of these lattice homotopy classification of possible atomic insulators. So that was done, and as you notice here, it's not published. The reason being, I for that particular classification, it may not be super interesting, and you should ask why. So the reason being, we are only talking about atomic insulators in this particular problem. We are thinking about some orbitals, and we say they are fully filled as an insulator. But you can say, like so what? They are just this. They are some quantum mechanical ground state, but you don't have any quantum entanglement. You just fully fill some atomic orbitals in space, so they don't seem like some very interesting quantum mechanical ground states, right? So that is a true statement. However, if you understand these atomic insulators very well, which are these protostates very well, they actually give you a gateway to finding the more non-trivial examples. And to do that, we specialize our discussion to electronic band theory. So let me just mention that so far, I've never assumed that the electrons are non-interacting. But for this particular problem, let me just restrict to that setting. So we only think about non-interacting electrons, such, and then we can go and describe them in momentum space. And this is really what, in condensed matter, we call that band theory, essentially. And when I specialize with this setting, and I focus on the symmetry representations, these complicated classifications, they simplify a little bit, and they all become some group of C to some power. So the picture we need is that Z to some power is almost like a vector space. If it's like R to some power, it's just like the real vector space. So this is not very different for our purpose. So what is important is that we can essentially do linear algebra with these C coefficients. So shown here is schematically the picture for Z squared. So these are like lattices, and you can think of these as two lattice vectors. So maybe in this two-dimensional space of possible atomic insulators, you have A1 and A2, and together they span a two-dimensional lattice. For the interest of time, I didn't go into the details, but then these, you can give them very explicit representation in terms of counts of symmetry representations. So maybe A1 you can associate with a collection of integers, and A2 you can also associate to some collection of integers. In particular, A2, we notice that if you do this, every integer there is actually even. So it's very natural to ask if this evenness is of any physical meaning, which is equivalent to asking if I could have taken half of this atomic insulator in terms of these representations of symmetry counts. And turns out the answer is yes, you can do it. And once you do it, then you will see that in fact you can attach this half lattice to any of the initial points. And what you get is an extended version of the space. So instead of just starting with the original z squared version of the atomic insulators, you realize that some of these you can actually take fractions, and that will generate these red dots. So this may be abstract, but if you trust me, you can make this a lot more concrete within the context of band theory. And you can prove that each of these points will basically be consistent band structures that have a gap at all high symmetry momenta. But at the same time, there cannot be anything which is atomic just by construction. It's like half of what it takes to be atomic. So this is really how you start getting interesting ground states that have some inherent quantum entanglement in it, because they are by definition not the trivial ones. And the structure is that you can also just compute another quotient group within this set. And this quotient group is what we call symmetry indicator in this paper. And we prove that this quotient group is actually always finite, and that has some interesting implication on how we can efficiently find topological materials. And that program has been carried out. So we've used that to basically look at all possible space groups and some large databases of known materials. And we've discovered what we call strong topological insulators, higher order topological crystalline insulators, the Dirac semi-metals, and so on and so forth. And this is a picture of some of the nicer looking ones, but we did find many possible candidates. And the idea is that experimenters can maybe take these as some guides, and they can try to look at some of these, and they can be interesting from a quantum material perspective. So with that, I've almost done with my talk, in fact. So let me just give you again a brief summary. So we started with this theorem that I call Lipschitz matters, and it's really about a no-go for getting boring phases, and it's understood in the beginning, or many years ago, by some other arguments. But in the more modern way of thinking about these, we realize that there's a topological content to it, and you can use that perspective and generalize it to essentially all possible space groups. So that's how we introduce the idea of lattice homotopy and study the general possibilities of having Lipschitz matters kind of no-go for quantum matlets. And lastly, we've also applied that idea to the study of atomic insulators and realized that you can, from that, you can kind of bootstrap it to the space of more general quantum materials. And that even guided us to find real space, real possible experimental candidates for realizing these interesting quantum mechanical ground states. And in an occasion like this, it's very hard to resist the temptation of asking what's next. So what will be the next frontier, at least from my personal perspective? So that is really to say we've kind of understood this real space picture and lattice homotopy, and everything is well defined in the real space. But when you really think about these topological materials that I mentioned at the very end, they are by definition not atomic. So a way to define these topological materials is that they inherently really don't like their local description while respecting all the symmetries. So there's an interesting interplay between symmetries and locality in these topological materials. So shown here is what we will say called a real space description of a two-dimensional topological insulator, which is shown here. So again, some honeycomb lattices. And it looks like you have spin up and down and is arranged in this particular manner. But what is non-trivial is that you're supposed to stare at this and conclude that it's time reversal symmetric. So you will say, like how can that be possible? And that's really the topological aspect of this kind of problems. So what happens is that if you insist on forcing a real space description of these topological insulators, you have to sacrifice on the representation of some symmetries, in particular time reversal here. So if I focus on this particular site, you can say it's like effectively some orbitals. And if you apply time reversal, turns out the only consistent assignment is that time reversal will take this site and kind of spread it into some superpositions of the nearby orbitals. So in other words, you can insist on using a real space description of these for these topological insulator or topological materials, But then the time reversal symmetry in this case cannot be fully manifest, or it has to be encoded in some highly non-trivial manner. And that is really what I think is one of the most interesting lessons that we've learned from the study of topological materials. So in condensed matter physics, we conventionally have essentially two extremes of interesting problems. The conventional side would mean something like well-localized electrons, maybe Haber models. And on the more topological side, that would be essentially quantum Hall physics, Landau-level problems. And what the topological materials are telling us is that essentially you have actually some intermediates between these two extremes. These are some lattice models, so this is a King-Millay model, but it's not fully conventional. It has some flavor of the topology. But at the same time, you don't have like a strong magnetic field. It's not really a Landau-level problem. And that was the kind of the first example. And turns out there's a really whole spectrum of all these variety. And they actually have different degrees of topology in it, which I don't know if there's a canonical ordering, but it's the ordering that I think makes sense. So from the very left-hand side, you have the most conventional Hubbard type of model. You can have things which are almost atomic, but with very weird kind of effective orbitals. And you have these things that we call fragile, which is some complicated stories that I would not go into today. And then you have different types of symmetry protected topological orders, maybe protected by internal symmetries or crystalline symmetries. And now the frontier to me is to ask the following question. This idea is really on understanding the Hilbert space and how symmetry acts. And now we know that these can be interacting. For instance, on the left-hand side, when you have a Hubbert model and strong interactions, spin half per unit cell, maybe a gas spin liquids. And on the right-hand side, you can get fractional quantum Hall states. So these are interesting states that are similar in some way, but also dissimilar in terms of how the energetics or the set of phases that are realized. And I think it's quite wildly open what would be the options if we take these alternatives and just add strong interactions and see what happens. Do we get something like an umbrella theory that describes all of them, or do you get new universal behavior? So that I think would be the frontier and would be what I would be interested in looking into in the future. So with that, I'll conclude by acknowledging my collaborators. So it's a fairly long list. Let me not name all of them, but just to say that these projects are interrelated, but then it wouldn't have been possible without all these help from these people. And with that, I'll end here. Thank you.
So I think it's a convention to start with student questions.
Yeah, any situation like this, I would take the favorable interpretation that I gave a super clear talk. But you can also object to that. Yes.
I thought to point out that if you give toy cars to babies, the other thing they try and do with them is put them in their mouths. And how would this fit in with the theme of your talk? Is that a wetting transition, a spin liquid, ordering, messing with the chemical potential?
Yeah, you know, like when we fill spin halves, they disappear, right? So you try to like get rid of them by swallowing them. That's what the baby was doing.
Yeah. So the smooth transformation that you define, mm-hmm. to define lattice homotopy.
Right.
Compared to the most general symmetric local unitary.
Right.
Your motions are much smaller set of transformation, is it right?
It actually depends on what you're trying to maintain. In fact, I think they're essentially equivalent if you're only caring about these Lipschitz matters type of conditions. So in fact, these LSM theorems, you can also understand it as the surface of some higher dimensional crystalline SPTs. And in the classification of these crystalline SPTs, you do think about all the possible local unitary transformation up to ancillas. So in fact, that is equivalent. So I think nothing is missed by just thinking about the lattice homotopy. So that the data you preserve is really just a projective representation. But if you want to preserve something different, then maybe the lattice homotopy will be different. So it's that depending on the rules.
I guess maybe you already answered the question. Mm-hmm. The question was, if you have two different states,
right.
the table, which mm-hmm. has a different invariant on
right, I see.
Homotopy Is it still possible that they can be mapped into each other under general local unitary transformation that respect the symmetry?
Right.
Space?
Right. So maybe the question, there are two contexts of that question. The first is the Lipschitz matrix kind of problem. So we are there, we're talking about the Hilbert space. It's a bit different. But the question you're asking is more about the states themselves. So if I think about atomic insulators, then you can actually make an argument that up to n zero degrees of freedom, the lattice homotopy equivalence is the same as the local unitary equivalence within the space of atomic insulators. Right. Yeah. So that is really equivalent within atomic insulators. If you admit ancillaries or like dissolve ancillaries. Yeah, but when you don't want ancillaries, you start getting these fragile things. So that's why that is kind of funny. It doesn't play well with the abelian group structure of any of these.
What's your, I didn't quite understand, what's your interest in ytterbium titanate specifically? So was there some unanswered question about the ground state there?
Oh, it's like, it's potentially a spin half. So you must know this very well, right? The spin ice compound. And this ytterbium one is one for which you have a pretty good isolated Kramer sublet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ground state. So, and it has a small spin, so there's a chance that it's like, it's not, it doesn't order. So maybe that can actually be a spin equal candidate in three dimensions. Yeah, except that you have four of the Kramers in each unit cell. So if you do these long, like at negative proofs, right, you don't see magnetic ordering and you say it's very clean, but it could just be some trivial phase. You have to ask if it's just a complicated spin singlet state or not. So by using Lipschitz matrix, you can prove that without symmetry breaking and with when disorder is unimportant, then it has to be a spin equid.
I see the latest, I haven't kept current on the latest experiments, but there's no evidence of ordering.
Not that I'm aware of, but one can double check. And not many groups studied that particular one. So.
Right.
Yeah. And the data quality hasn't been super good so far.
You mentioned Dirac semi-levels,
mm-hmm.
part of the classification table.
Right, right.
So your techniques can also be used to
predict
when something is Dirac semi-level?
That's right, actually, yes. So we think about these atomic insulators as an anchor in some way. And you can now compare that with the space of possible band structures. And that would include also these semi-metallic behavior. Although it's not like something, a nice phase that you can classify in a more serious sense because it's gapless. But then in within the applicability of band theory, then you can just treat all these in the same way almost.
So is it possible to write down a topology invariant explicitly for the lattice homotopy?
So for maybe this honeycomb triangular example I gave, you can think of the invariant as basically saying it's generated by two elements. The first one will be half integer spin on triangular, and the other one will be half integer spin on the kagome. And any possible lattice in that setup, you can expand it using these. And then the when you do the expansion, then the invariant will be the two I mentioned. So that's as explicit as it gets. I don't know how to make it. It's a number. It's maybe a more abstract number, but it's still something like a number.
Is it related to some physical observables?
To the extent that gives you a constraint on whether the ground state can be featureless, that's a physical observable. Like whether you can get an AKLT-like state, for instance, that's like a physical observable.
Some number is just the projective representation in each unit cell?
Say again?
Is that number just the projective representation in each unit cell?
No, maybe I should write. So the two invariants are, let me call that 1-0 being the class of triangular and projective. And 0-1 will be kagome and projective. So now you can think about the 1-1 entry. So 1-1 entry would have like one spin half and three spin half. So when you think about the 1-1 entry, it's the sum of these two. So that will actually have an integer spin per unit cell. And you cannot think about it as some fundamental domain or whatnot, it's not non-symmorphic. But still we have this is a non-trivial lattice because the trivial one is 0-0. So this is something with LSM. But not in a conventional sense, not in terms of the half integer spin per unit cell.
So you showed that half integer honeycomb lattice is equivalent to an integer spin kagome lattice, right?
Right.
So is it like for the integer spin kagome lattice, mm-hmm. each each lattice site should have only a spin zero, or if I take a spin one, it's also.
Right, yeah.
Will
so,
it have an equivalence or not?
Yeah, so we also assume all the integer spins are essentially equivalent.
Okay.
So which is the case if you allow for ancillaries essentially. But there are interesting questions on whether you get special restrictions for a given Hilbert space. If I only have spin, so that's such a famous example of a small system of a tetrahedron of spin half. It looks like you have integer spins altogether. You have four spin half, for instance. But turns out you cannot write down a singlet state. You have a spin singlet, but it's degenerate. So you can have get that kind of funny obstructions when you really focus on some specific number of spins. But then what we are doing here is to essentially admit for arbitrary trivial ancillaries. And then once you do that, then 0 and 1 and 2, they're kind of the same.
Okay, well, Adrian's also here tomorrow, and I think that's sometime on the schedule. So if you have any questions, feel free to connect in. So let's thank Adrian.
Yep.